For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Brendan Gulston of Gresham House. So welcome, Brendan.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to be back on the show, especially given all the sort of volatility of late. We've got sort of a waning business confidence in the UK, hotter than expected CPI out in the States, and the threat of more trade tariffs from President Trump. So putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for equities for the rest of the year, especially in your sort of sweet spot of small and mid caps?
Yeah, look, I think there's, as always, there's definitely a lot going on from a kind of macro and global perspective. There's quite a bit of noise. I think, you know, we're pretty positive and optimistic about UK and UK small caps. You know, I think you pointed to some of the kind of economic headlines, and I think, you know, there's a lot of media kind of sentiment around how, you know, the UK is not open for growth and how our economy is challenged. But I think if you look at, you know, comparatively versus other countries in Europe, it's not actually that bad. And, you know, there is, the interest rates are coming down, perhaps not as fast as expected. But, you know, I think quite a few sort of economic indicators do look better than they're sort of portrayed to be, particularly, you know, things around the consumer. You know, again, all you read about is sort of how the consumer's challenged, but actually, you know, there's the corporate and consumer balance sheets look pretty strong. I think spending in, you know, over Christmas was better. So I think there's definitely a bit of noise, and there's, you know, sort of reducing some of that complexity is kind of where we're focused. And I think, you know, within the UK market, there's the valuation, you know, the valuations are just so compelling, particularly at the small cap end. And, you know, there's been a few things contributing to that. There's been, you know, the kind of AIM sell-off last year and the run-up to the budget. There's been the ongoing sort of fund flow dynamic, which everyone will be aware of. But I think, you know, when you take a step back and you look at what kind of businesses can we buy, what are the sort of operating fundamentals, how are these businesses actually tracking from a sort of bottom-up kind of trading perspective, and then you look at what you have to pay for them, it's one of the most compelling times to be able to deploy capital into this part of the market. So I think for the patient investor, it's a great time to be doing this, and there's a lot to be excited about.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm sort of adding to my positions at the moment at these sort of rock bottom levels. And certainly if you've got a sort of 3 to 5 year time horizon, I think it's it really is very good pickings. I mean, admittedly, there'll be a bit more volatility, but even so, if you can ride through that, then I'll tell it with you. If anybody wants to ask Brendan any questions, please put them into the chat box. We've got plenty coming through already. Let's start with one of your sort of like winners at the moment. Let's go for MPAC, which is a high-speed packaging stroke factory automation expert. It just made a couple of acquisitions at the back end of last year, one in Europe, one in the States, to extend its product line. How do you see this one going forward? Because it really has been a thoroughbred for you.
Yeah, so look, this has been it's been a strong performer. It's still very cheap. You know, the thesis here is really around, you know, this is a good business in a space which has got some long-term structural tailwinds. So, you know, providing kind of automation machinery into very blue chip clients is taking advantage of, you know, things like shrinking labor force, the rising costs in sort of factories and sort of manufacturing facilities, and the need to automate. And so, you know, you've got some pretty positive demand drivers. You've also got the the kind of rising installed base of the equipment that they're selling in to their customers means that the proportion of kind of recurring or repeat invisible revenues is increasing as a proportion, which is again quite attractive from a quality of earnings perspective. They've also, you know, I think there's definitely a, there's a sort of discount, there's a discount to the business because it's, you know, UK listed, but also because of scale. So, you know, the acquisitions that they've done two acquisitions. I think both of them were 6x EV EBITDA, which is slightly below, I think, where Mpac's trading about 7x, both accretive on a pre-synergy basis, and both, you know, strategically very sensible acquisitions. So, you know, sort of taking all the boxes at the moment, it's growing in terms of scale, it's performing well, still trades at a big discount to the sector. So, you know, I think that, that's got a lot of potential going forward. And, you know, at some point that will sort of see a re-rating over time, but, you know, happy to hold it in the meantime.
Yeah, I think he's got some exposure to the US. And when it comes to sort of, there are sort of import trade tariffs, then I think it just has facilities, doesn't it? Both sides are sort of like one in America, one in Canada, and it may even have some in Mexico. So what's your sort of view in terms of, it should be well positioned, I would have thought, for the trade tariffs if they do come along?
Yeah, it should be. Look, it's sort of diversified from that perspective. I think it's quite, to be honest, I think it's quite hard to tell at this stage in terms of some of the specific impact around the tariffs. You know, they are sort of quite broad based at the moment, quite high level. But you know, something like this business is, you know, it's got a sort of hedge on that, given that, you know, it can, you know, some of the customers are already based in out in the US, as you say.
Yep. Okay, good. Another one on the sort of automation theme, but this term's in software, is Active Ops, which basically helps automate sort of like a hybrid workforce, some in the office, some at home, etc., particularly in the sort of the financial and sort of healthcare sectors, and sorry, insurance sectors and the BPO sectors as well. How do you see this one? The shares have sort of fallen relatively recently, but trading about 2.2x EV sales for a sort of good quality software business with recurring revenues.
Yeah. So this, again, similarly to Mpac, it, you know, there are really positive long-term structural tailwinds for this business. So it's, yeah, it's a kind of, you know, this business sort of plays into some of the themes around adopting kind of automation, particularly within sort of large financial institutions, managing a kind of hybrid workforce, and also kind of, you know, managing, so, you know, managing things like software tools as well as people, but then also managing, you know, kind of remote working, the hybrid working environment as well. And it's a sort of orchestration layer that sort of feeds into some of the underlying kind of, you know, sort of people-based systems and, you know, timesheet systems. And so, you know, it kind of allows sort of big financial institutions to, you know, drive quite material efficiencies across their workforce, and it's a distributed workforce, it's quite complex in nature. And, you know, we've seen this since IPO, it's been growing consistently over time. It's, you know, high degree of recurring revenue, it's high margin, you know, gross margins are, I think, 80% plus. It's been investing over the past few years in sort of driving the growth agenda. So you've seen the EBITDA percentage is quite low at the moment, and the cash EBITDA is sort of inflecting. I suspect as you start to see that scale, the shares should re-rate. But you're right, it's come off, you know, it's come off fairly recently. They did have a contract which they lost, which was just over $1 million ARR in the context of about 26 million of ARR across the business. So, you know, that was, they had highlighted that was, that contract was sort of already on risk, if you like, and they adopted a kind of internal system. It didn't affect the numbers, so they kind of had enough contingency in their numbers. So, but nonetheless, the market took that negatively. But I think if you look at this now, I mean, it's 73 million market cap, 13 odd million net cash, 60 million EV. The underlying metrics, the SaaS metrics are pretty strong as well. So, yeah, I think we've spoken about it before, the net retention rate, which is, you know, the kind of percentage growth or decline that you get from your existing customer base moving in terms of full exits, upsell, downsell. That on a constant currency basis, I think was 110%. So the company basically grows 10% without having to win any new customers. Yeah, that's pretty, you know, that's quite strong. So,
yeah.
And that's on an EV/ARR of 2.3 times, which is just completely the wrong price. And yeah. You know, going back to my sort of opening comments on valuations, there's a real, you know, in the SaaS, in the software and the kind of the SaaS segment of the UK market, probably sub 500 million, but definitely at the smaller end of that, there's a lot of sort of unloved businesses that trade at, you know, kind of half or worse the price that they should really trade on. You know, something like this, if you looked at, if this was a private business, it would probably be valued at, you know, 5 times ARR, if not higher.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's a real opportunity with some of these businesses. And, you know, there's one that we had in our portfolio, which was taken out at a much higher multiple than 2.3 times.
This was Wynwood, presumably.
Wynwood, yeah.
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 Well done.
Yeah, that, you know, that was, yeah, it's a great business, that. I think we have spoken about this before. It's a sort of predictive intelligence for maritime assets.
Yeah.
Like 90% recurring, high margin, growing really strongly, really compelling value proposition and position in the market. And it was taken private. It was being taken private by a PE firm. I think the business was valued at 216 million, fully diluted. And it's about 50% premium to the Friday close, and on a 6 and 12 month VWAP is over a 90% premium. The 2025 EV sales figure is about 6 times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you take that in the context of, I mean, we sort of struggled to find anything trading at that 6 times in the UK smaller cap end of the market. But in the, you know, in the private world, that is, you know, things are going for sort of mid to high single digit EV/ARR multiples. So, you know, there's a real, you know, you think something like ActiveOps and others, there's a real, you know, sort of value play from, you know, kind of ongoing growth. But no doubt someone might look at any of those businesses and decide to try and, you know, take a private.
Yeah, I think the only one which is trading at a small software business trading at sort of 5-6 times EV sales as I've seen is Pinewood Technologies, which is that dealership management business that's knocking the ball out of the park as well. Okay, good. That's three brilliant stocks which have done well. Let's hit a couple of questions. We've got both Ben Sharman and James Everestingly asking about our Gentex, which is a sort of like a cross-border Forex international payments company that helps companies and fund managers and certain high net worth individuals transfer money abroad. Really a sort of like a white glove silver service type business that is now overlaying or building an alternative banking solution on the back of it. It does seem now to be turning. They had a good second half with some good sales. What's your sort of your latest view on this?
Yeah, so look, this is one that hasn't gone as well as the previous ones for us. It's a sort of corporate FX solutions business. It's not that dissimilar from Alpha Group, except I suppose the sort of alternative banking proposition has been kind of underinvested historically. So Alpha's done a great job of building that out, which is what Argentex is now seeking to do. But you're right that this has been something that has been in a kind of turnaround. It's been in transition. There's been a lot of change that's gone on here, from, you know, management change through to you know, kind of sort of shift of strategy to accelerate that alternative banking proposition, through to cost cutting, resetting of forecasts. So, I mean, just about everything that you would change in a turnaround has happened.
I think there's a new CEO, a new CFO, and a new chairman.
Yeah. And I think across the business, there's been sort of people change as well. Not just at the kind of exact level. And so, look, that's always, I mean, that kind of thing always takes a bit of time, you know, in terms of operationally sort of implementing change to then start delivering kind of an improvement in the earnings figures. But also, the market just has a bit of a lagged view to that as well. So it's taken a while. It's definitely turned a corner, though. You know, you saw the recent trading update, which, you know, the revenues were sort of marginally ahead, but the profits were ahead. And, you know, this is a business which sort of makes about 50 million of revenue. They are investing quite materially in this, as we said, sort of tech proposition. And so, you know, I think for the current year, the kind of EBITDA margin is going to be low single digit percentage. And I think the way to look at this is kind of don't expect too much in terms of profits for the next couple of years. But if you take a 3-year view here, you know, there's no reason why this business can't generate in excess of 10 million of EBITDA. And the EV is maybe 40 million today. Mm-hmm. I think this is one which is starting to, you know, a lot of the hard work has been done. The profits won't be coming through materially, you know, unless over the next kind of 18 months or so. But I think that this is one that is going to start inflecting. And I think also that what some of the change around, you know, the alternative banking proposition kind of takes the business away from, you know, reliance on kind of a kind of corporate uncertainty around, you know, FX volatility and that kind of thing. And so it improves the quality of earnings. It also improves profitability because it's quite high margin, some of those services. And they've got a great position from which to leverage that with their sort of already captive customer base on the institutional side. So, you know, I think it looks very cheap on a 3-year view if you're patient. And most of the pain has been sort of,
yes,
we've been through most of the pain, hopefully.
Yeah. I did, I was doing just sort of re-engineering the numbers, and I think they did about 26 or 26 and a half million pounds revenue second half compared to 23, sort of 23 and a half, I think, first half. And I think the broker at the Singers only had 19 or something like that, just less than 20 in the second half. So they blew past the brokers, which means that customers are sticking with it. And when you come to sort of like look at the EBITDA, they have been investing in this new alternative banking solution, and again, reverse engineering. If they did 3 million of investment last year, 3 million this year, that's 15% of EBITDA, which is just purely investment income, which is being expensed. So you'd think actually, you know, their EBITDA, as soon as they finish that investment, they should see quite a big snapback in margins of EBITDA, I would have thought. And I don't know what your reasoning is.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the core business is, well, firstly, the forecasts were to reset to be deliverable. I think the core business, there's been some change around, you know, across the organization to, you know, around things like incentivization structures and how people think about, you know, kind of existing customers and winning new business. So I think that, you know, the core part of the business has been improved, and that, as you say, you started to see that come back in terms of the second half revenue line. If you weren't investing in the tech platform, then this business would be making fairly material profits.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a trade-off in terms of, you know, the short-term versus long-term potential here. And, you know, that's going to be building a much, you know, much more profitable business longer term. The alternative banking part plus a kind of strategically more valuable business as well.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's go to another question. We've got Darton Trading. He's asking about data center stroke sort of like cybersecurity AI services business in the UK called IOMart that used to be a darling and unfortunately is going through a bit of a turnaround itself. It bought a business, ATEC, last year, which added a lot of cyber and AI capability on top of its existing sort of data centers, which was strategically a good move, but it looked quite an expensive price, put a lot of debt on the balance sheet, and clearly people are sort of like wondering about what the whether it's going to need a fundraise next year if it sort of breached its banking covenants. I don't know how you see this one and what the likelihood is of a turnaround, because it has been very painful for shareholders.
Yeah, it has been painful. The profit warning was disappointing, obviously. The ATEC business is performing pretty well. I think the challenge that we've seen is that in another part of their business, which is the kind of smaller end of customers who mostly kind of self-serve, that the churn is sort of being elevated in that segment of the business. And it's, you know, a minority part of the business, but it's very high margin because of that self-serve element. So that bit has accelerated. And, you know, from a revenue perspective, you look at the trading update or the profit warning, revenues, I think they were okay on revenues, but because that other bit is high margin, there was a 10% downgrade to EBITDA. So obviously that's, you know, very disappointing. But if you look at it today, it's, you know, the EBITDA I think is downgraded to about 34 million.
Yeah.
Got, I think, net debt 95 to 98 million. So it's probably at that, you know, it's more than the market would typically like to tolerate, which is probably why the shares are trading where they are today. 140 million EV, it's sort of four times the current EBITDA. So, you know, that again is you know, if you look at the wider sector, then, you know, the multiples are sort of 10 to 12 times probably. So it's a pretty big discount to the wider sector. The core business is actually performing okay. All of the sort of structural tailwinds around, you know, hybrid hosting and catering to the kind of SME and mid-market space are still completely valid. But it's just, you know, the kind of slightly outside of their control, the accelerated churn. So, you know, I think at the moment that this business is looking very, very cheap. The market, obviously, as I said, is not looking particularly favorably on the debt position. But that, I guess, is, you know, anything over two times and the market, you know, there's a, I guess, a bit of a discount that seems to be implied, you know, above two times.
Yeah. Can they sell any assets like Easy Space at all, which they have there, so the non-core ones, to take that debt down?
Yeah, they could do. Yeah, I think Easy Space is the sort of domain name business. Yeah. I mean, I think Minds and Machines was sold a few years ago to GoDaddy, which is in a broadly similar space at a pretty attractive valuation. Team Internet's also in, I think it's had a few announced offers or one announced offer. So there's definitely, you know, that is an active M&A space. And yeah, look, that might be one way that the company sort of tries to allay the kind of market, you know, market concerns. but yeah, so not an on-call part.
Yeah. Well, we're looking to you, Brendan, given you're a big shareholder, to give the sort of aggression magic on top of their strategy to
aggression magic, yeah.
Yeah, well, you've done pretty well in the past. Okay, let's move to SIS Group, which is a managed IT services business.
Yeah.
Again, sort of covering cybersecurity, hosting and AI consultancy, largely for SMEs, I think. And the exec chairman, they came out with a sort of a bit of a profit warning. I think it was in December. The shares didn't do so. But the exec chairman then just loaded up again, sort of backed up the truck and bought a shed load of shares, which is obviously a good sign. How are you seeing this one going forward? Quite a tough space, actually, small and medium size, you know, companies servicing them.
Yeah. So it's a kind of similar theme to IMR. Again, it focuses on slightly smaller end, but there's quite a few structural tailwinds here as well, particularly around, you know, sort of allowing smaller businesses to, you know, try and use AI within their business and offering them kind of more flexibility to do so from a kind of IT services and hosting perspective. Whereas, you know, they wouldn't be able to do that if they were trying to get, you know, a rack with GPT on with one of the bigger providers. So, you know, they're well positioned. the reason why the shares have been, well, they sort of dipped down at almost 15p was because they did, you know, they disappointed at the end of last year, sort of pointed to extended sales cycles. So there's been a bit of a kind of trying to focus on the higher margin, higher quality customers, rather than some of the very small customers who are, you know, kind of take up more time and aren't as profitable. Where they focus, there's been a slightly extended sales cycle. But, you know, this business is, you know, it is very well positioned in this market. It's, you know, if you take a longer term view here, it is a structurally growing part of the market. They have also, they've sort of acquired a kind of cybersecurity consulting business, which again is quite attractive to be able to allow them to sort of bundle additional services. So, you know, they're sort of expanding their value proposition and their offering. I think that was quite an attractive acquisition for them. So the market, obviously, you know, sort of extended sales cycles and disappointing on your near-term numbers. It's not going to go down well. But then, as you said, you know, the insider buying is, you know, is pretty compelling. I think the exec chair, he owns sort of 10-odd%. Yeah. He bought 800,000 shares at, I think, 17 or 19p a share. So there's good alignment. And, you know, this business is, it's going to take a little bit longer to get to this, I think, the 2 to 3 million of EBITDA that's in the market. But, you know, it's very, very cheap. Again, similarly to IMART, very cheap.
Yeah. Now, when an exec chairman sort of like dips into his pocket and buys a meaningful amount of shares on a couple of occasions, it says to me that he sees something in there that most normal outsiders can't really appreciate. Okay, we've got a question from Nigel Batty Seams. He's asking about whether you still hold XPS pensions, because you talked about it last time, and it's done fabulous. It's obviously benefited on all the regulation of pensions coming into the UK with things like equalization between men and women in terms of, and sort of age discrimination and stuff like this. But I think I had a trading update, if I remember correctly, a trading update last week, and it blew through expectations. Well, what's your latest on this one?
So we still hold it. This is, it's been in a kind of earnings upgrade cycle. We think that there's a lot to like about this business. So you've got great market backdrop, as you alluded to, in terms of actually the proper, you know, kind of long-term secular drivers here, whether it's sort of increasing regulatory work, compliance, GMP equalization. The landscape for kind of defined benefit pensions consultancy just gets more and more onerous. So, you know, the market is supportive of these types of businesses. You've then also got their market position is really attractive. So they're now the leading independent provider of pensions consultancy, winning business or some of the big players, you know, given their kind of pure play focus on that. So good market position leading to strong contract momentum. You then got, we've seen the inflation linked contracts through the last couple of years been clearly very, very helpful for the financials. But the crucial thing that we've started to see over the last few years has been, well, sort of 18 months has been the operational leverage. So that's, as that started to come through, this business has been sort of upgrading quite frequently. So, it's been a good performer. You know, it has re-rated a bit. It's still not that expensive. We have sold a little bit across some of our funds on, you know, as it's performed, it's sort of gone towards the upper end of some of the kind of tolerance levels for some of the open-ended funds. So we've just trimmed a bit, but, you know, it's still a very much a core holding for us. And we expect this to continue to outperform, probably more upgrades coming. It's just a high quality business generating a lot of cash, well positioned.
Yeah, well, it's an almost four bag, doesn't it, in 2.5 years? So I always thought pensions were boring, but maybe I was wrong there. I need to revisit that. Okay, got a question from Lendon Physical. He's asking about Vet Expert CVS Group. Do you own this one at all? Which is basically, I think, the number one sort of like a provider of vet services in the UK. It's got that overhang of the CMA review, which I think they're expecting a result in May, actually, coming up shortly, or around that sort of time. How do you see this one? The they've had flat, I think, growth in the UK and reasonable growth in Australia, which is their other geographical location.
Yeah, we own this in our small cap fund. We also own Pets at Home, which has got their sort of vet practices as well. And interestingly, if you look at Pets, their recent update showed that like-for-like growth on the pet side, I think, was 20% organic. Yep. Really strong. It's been double digit for the last, I don't know, 4 to 6 quarters. So we are, fundamentally, we're really positive on the pet market. Again, secular drivers in terms of rising pet ownership, rising spend on pets. There's also the, I think they call it the smile, which is, you know, years one and two, the very, you know, the highest sort of cost of owning a pet. And then sort of year six and seven onwards when they become ill. And there's a sort of, if you think a lot of people decided to sort of get pets during COVID, you know, we're getting close to the back end of the smile where there's an additional kind of catalyst for increased spend for both of those businesses. So again, I think we're not too far from seeing a kind of a bit of an accelerated growth profile there. I think CVS has been a business which has been a bit of historically a number of years ago and been a bit of a stock market darling, derated significantly, in part due to the sort of CMA overhang. Our view is that, you know, we think that this business is sort of positioned on the right side of that from a kind of transparency and pricing perspective. But I guess more importantly, I just think that the share price overreaction, what the market is factoring in, is just way too negative versus the likely result of the CMA. So we think that's massively overdone. And so we're sort of happy holding that at definitely these levels.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's how much is that doggy in the window with both of those. But coming to another stock with plenty of fears or potential fears is Nichols, which is a fizzy drink maker, owns the iconic brands Vimto and Slush Puppy. I think it came out with a decent trading update recently, if I remember rightly. But how do you see this one going forward?
You a happy Vimto consumer, Paul?
I can't drink fizzy drink just because I've got a medical condition. But I heard a lot of people love it.
Yeah, it's got a very loyal following.
Yes.
Look, this one we bought into this last year. Again, we've sort of known about this and tracked it for a while. What we like about it is that they've got a very kind of loyal set of customers, good following. And B, they've got the business model is really attractive. So sort of capital light business model, where, you know, similar to Coca-Cola, I guess they kind of produce the concentrate effectively, which underpins high, you know, sort of high profit margins. And it also sort of improves that quality of earnings. So, we like that about it. It's been, there's quite a few sort of levers to drive earnings growth as well, which we felt were perhaps being slightly overlooked. So the first is the business is actually growing organically really strongly in terms of distribution. They've been taking advantage slightly of some of the grocers and some of the retailers sort of de-emphasizing Ribena. So since the acquisition by Suntory, that has been sort of underinvested, and you know, Vimto has been taking, I guess, sort of shelf space and share from Ribena and from others. We did a bit of channel checking with, you know, across the retailers, and we got a pretty positive kind of response on how Nichols, the company, approaches new product and innovation and keeping, you know, keeping the range kind of fresh and appealing to consumers and therefore sort of outselling their competitors. So we think that's an ongoing trend. That's, you'll see that sort of starting to come through in the numbers. The other point is around, they've got a bit of business in Africa. Again, but it's all sort of they do it via a strategic partner. But they've changed the model to, rather than finishing the product and then sort of shipping it, well, not them, but their partner, it's going to shift to in-country finishing in Africa. And so that has the advantage of, for the distributors in Africa, they would previously have to pay quite high import tariffs because they're buying a finished product. Whereas if they finish it in Africa, they don't have to pay those tariffs. So it improves the supply chain, but it also frees up working capital for those distributors to then spend more on acquiring product and selling it through into Africa. So that's quite a sort of material potential improvement, I think, in the earnings potential here. There's then some also quite tangible cost savings. They've been implementing a new ERP system and other cost savings across the group. So again, supportive of growing the bottom line. And also the balance sheet's really strong. So, you know, they paid out a special dividend. They got over 50 million of net cash. Yeah, the dividend yield's attractive without special dividends, but I think you can expect ongoing special dividends to be a sort of feature in the future. And yeah, so we bought this. There was a bit of share price weakness in the, it's been an IHT name. So the shares came off down to sort of, I think, £10 before the budget. Yeah. So we had been sort of buying around those levels. again, an attractive entry point. It's performing well. They've gone up a bit more since then. But I just think it's a great long-term business. You know, if you look at the target total return across dividends, capital growth, yeah, good quality of earnings, great business model. It's a lot to like there.
Yeah, margin story and potential consolidation. So there is a lot. You're right. There's a lot there you can look forward to. Okay, let's move to another darling that had a bit of a sort of like a softer patch recently, particularly in its sausage rolls. Is Greggs, the iconic sort of like high street delicatessen provider and food provider. How do you see this? Is this just a temporary effect, or is this a more sort of like a structural sort of effect that their like for likes have decreased over last year? I think they were about 7% at the start of the year, 7-8%, went down to 5% at Q3, and then dropped to less than 3% like for likes in Q4.
Yeah, just over 2%, I think.
Yeah.
So I'd say a couple of things on this. I'd say there is, as I sort of said right at the start, there's a bit of a, well, there's definitely some negativity across the consumer space, and we've seen, you know, even if it's the kind of the value end consumer staples through to the more at risk sort of big ticket discretionary items, is the market is not, it's not that sophisticated, it's not as sophisticated as it should be in terms of differentiating. So Greggs, you know, is one of a few companies that has updated in the last sort of 3 or 4 months, where it's been in line, but there's been a kind of sell-off around kind of like-for-likes not being as high as would be expected. The other one was B&M. And, you know, the company, they pointed to sort of footfall challenges. They did say they'd be in line for the year. And... you know, I think the market reaction is just way overdone here. Mm. So, you know, this, if you think about it, this is a business with a very strong footprint across the UK. You know, if it increases prices by 1%, it offsets the entire impact of the sort of budgetary changes in terms of costs. Got very strong sort of store rollout or site rollout plan, which they're executing on. They've got some quite attractive levers to drive earnings growth, including, you know, some of these are discounted by the market, but, you know, the kind of the evening proposition is one of them. The loyalty is another one. But just the, you know, the kind of, the increasing sort of revenue density across the existing estate, again, should be, you know, the customer footfall is, we believe, a transitory factor. And, you know, ultimately, we think this, as if you look at where this is positioned from a kind of price perspective, if you look at, you know, the operational execution in terms of driving kind of revenue density, whether it's through loyalty or through kind of expanding the range, you know, this is a business that should continue to take share. And as you drive, as we've seen across some other businesses where you have a large kind of installed base and you drive revenue density and sort of average basket size, and you get quite material drop through to profitability. So I think that, the market doesn't like the weaker like for likes. It's probably taking too short term a view, probably thinking that new sites are cannibalizing existing sites. I think ultimately our view is different to that. We think that this is, you know, this is a sort of structurally growing long-term performer with some sort of minor sort of headwinds at the moment. So we had been buying a bit more down at current levels. I think this is, again, one to watch over the next sort of 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I think a lot of the problems anyway, around about, you know, Q4 Christmas time, was simply they couldn't sort of process the number of people in the line quick enough. And a lot of people just got annoyed and just left. I mean, every time I went down to London or into central Birmingham and went past the Greggs store, it was out the door, which means that they're not processing people as fast as that. If they got that sort of like the logistics, particularly at peak hours time in the morning or lunchtime, if they got that sorted out, I bet their line for likes would at least would have been double what they were in, you know, sort of like reported. But
too much demand for the Christmas rolls.
Nice problem to have. Okay, good. Let's go to a company we hardly ever talk about. In fact, I've never talked about it to a fund manager. Is Ten Lifestyle, which is basically a sort of like a concierge service for high net worth individuals. It acts as the conduit between the sort of the wealthy banks and helps their ultra high net worth customers. It's like a retention or marketing system for the banks. They then provide the sort of like, you know, exclusive dining and events and experiences for their clients. How would you see this one? The shares have sold off, but they did a fundraise, I think, before Christmas. So the balance sheet is really quite strong, actually.
This is one that I don't think many people are really looking at.
That's a very understated statement. That is the
This is a share price chart to relish. So we invested fairly recently as part of the fundraising. We'd been looking at this and always sort of just trying to get our heads around, I guess, why it was so cheap and what we're missing. And look, I think firstly, there's some attractive dynamics in the sector. There's a competitor which I think is sort of quite challenged and losing business. This business, Ten Lifestyle, has got great contract momentum, as you said, and it's pushing forward pretty strongly. I think the forecast EBITDA is 13.5 million EBITDA. When this IPO'd, it probably IPO'd at the wrong price. It's now definitely gone the other way to be the wrong price. It's I think they got a good market position, taking advantage of some weakness from competitors. But you know, irrespective of that, the contracts are building pretty strongly and are starting to come through. There's also a bit of a shift away from some of these businesses had been quite heavy on kind of lifestyle managers. So people you call up and say you want to get tickets to an event or something. And, you know, it's been quite sort of people heavy, and Ten is sort of shifting towards a kind of self-service model, which is obviously going to start coming through from an earnings perspective. And, so the drop through to the bottom line, again, we expect to accelerate. It's got a market cap of about 44 million. It's got 4 million, I think, of net cash on 13.5x EBITDA. So, it's pretty cheap. It's very cheap. It's not pretty cheap. And it's sort of priced. I mean, there are a few businesses in cross sector sub 100 million market cap, which are kind of in a similar situation where they're profitable, generating cash, decent balance sheet, growing, and they're sub 5x EBITDA, and the market is sort of pricing them as if they're going to go bust. And you know, this is not one of those. So we think that's just completely the wrong price. And yeah, ultimately, I think with a lot of these businesses, as the operating performance starts to continue to be delivered, you know, the shares will start to go up. You know, I think there's a bit of a kind of short-termism that's being applied to, you know, even companies that hit their numbers or upgrade, and you know, you can sort of maybe ignore it for one or two periods, but ultimately, we think, as I said at the start, take a three-year view. I don't think this will be trading at 3x EBITDA.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, let's tie a bow on the consumer. We've got a question from Ben Sharman. He's asking about Angling Direct, which I think is the UK's number one shop provider for sort of like all things fishing tackle and lines and hooks and stuff like that, both online and with its actual shops. I think it's got a big position in the UK and then has tried to have a beachhead in Europe. Just a quick words on Angling Direct.
So we own quite a lot of this. We're 27-28% shareholder. Again, it's completely different business to Ten Lifestyle, but probably, so last time I looked at it, it was like 36 million market cap, half of the market cap in cash.
Yep.
And like 3x-4x EBITDA. Profitable. It's I think Europe's been a bit of a drag on profits. If you were to take that out, I mean, the profitability is, I think, maybe a million EBITDA higher. Nonetheless, you know, this is a decently profitable business and growing. Strong market position, omni-channel, you know, sort of online and in store. And, you know, this is a hobbyist enthusiast sort of customer base with very high loyalty, very high average spend, very high sort of repeat custom. So you know, this again is just it's far too cheap. And you know, having half the market cap in cash is just slightly ridiculous, I guess. You know, this business doesn't need that much cash. But it's you know, it's still quite a small business, and it's very much probably under the radar for a lot of investors. But again, I think you know if you're patient and happy to hold it, you know, the free cash flow yield is enough to sort of deliver a pretty attractive return over the next 3 years without re-rating. So that's one that is kind of deep value, I think.
Yeah, literally. As it's fishing around. Okay, yeah. we've got a question from Carcosa. I don't think you own it actually, Berendon, but just to double check. He's asking about Supreme, which is a FMCG products company in the UK. Does batteries, lighting, vaping, and
No, we don't. I met it at the IPO, and we didn't go for it. I think it was sort of quite a big reliance on kind of vaping and.
Yeah.
I think we were slightly concerned about the sort of longer term quality of earnings with that. So I don't know. I haven't really followed it too closely.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, let's move to MedTech. We've got Ixico, quite a small business, basically as an expert in analyzing brain scans for neurological diseases like Huntington's, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Got a new CEO about 6 months ago. They did a fundraise. And they had quite a strong second half last year compared to the first half. The order book increased as well. There's a lot of big investment by biotech into this whole space because there was one drug which has been put onto the app. Well, two drugs actually have been released into the market. But we've got Roche, you've got Bristol Myers. I think AbbVie are also doing quite a lot of stuff in it. How do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, so really interesting space this. And you know, in the last 5 years, we've seen probably more positive developments in neurodegenerative disease areas, CNS, than in the last 20 years. It's a notoriously difficult sort of indication or set of indications to try and solve for various reasons. It's incredibly complex. Not that sort of any other drug discovery is particularly easy, but It's so look, I think that this is a kind of end market. Neurodegeneration has become a real focus area for a number of big pharma and biotechs. The amount of money put into these trials, the number of trials that have been that we've seen start over the last 5 years has increased materially. So, in terms of a kind of the ecosystem has become pretty attractive to be in. Ixeko is quite interesting. It's a very small business, but it's got a really, really strong value proposition, and it's got, you know, really kind of compelling offering. So they combine sort of neuroscientists with AI to help some of these pharma companies and biotechs to run sort of clinical imaging analysis across clinical trials, and they use their tools to measure brain atrophy and certain primary and secondary endpoints. So this is they started out in Huntington's. They've got a very strong market position there. They raised some money, as you said, last year. We participated in that fundraise to sort of shore up the balance sheet. And so the business has got, I think, at the end of last year, had some 5 to 6 million in net cash. It sort of made about 6 million in revenues for September 24. I think their break even is probably 8 to 8.5 million of revenue. Yep. Good visibility on September 25. So I think, most of that was already covered. And they raised some of the money to really leverage their position in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's in specific areas to build out data sets, build out kind of research projects and expertise to launch additional functionality, because the market in Alzheimer's is much bigger and they've got a strong pipeline there, but they need to increase their win rate. And so, I think when I met, I spent quite a lot of time with them, and they've really been quite focused in terms of tangibly being able to point to, if we do X, Y, and Z, we'll add functionality, we'll be able to win these contracts. And, so I think that business is really well positioned in terms of, the potential growth that they could see is very material. It's also just, it's playing massively into that kind of adopting AI to improve outcomes and efficiencies, and probably a strategic asset as well. So that is definitely one that we're quite excited about. It's small, but it's in our VCTs, but I think that could be, over the next 3 years, could be really a really strong outperformer.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. Let's just switch sectors. We're running fairly short of time. We've gone to financial services. Let's do Fintel, because we don't hardly ever cover that company. It's an expert in providing data and advice and information to IFAs and also to individuals to help people make better investment decisions. It's been on a buy and build strategy, and now they've got one CEO, Matt Timmins. How do you see this one going forward? Lots of recurring revenue, good margins.
Yeah, look, the story here has been, it's been evolving from kind of outsourced compliance service provided to IFAs into being a sort of two-sided digital technology and data platform for fund buyers and fund management groups. That was initially through the acquisition of Defacto. So I think the way we see it is it's continued to deliver operationally. They did 2024 numbers in line, 20% revenue growth. EBITDA growth was below that because of they've been investing in the business. Trades at sub 12 times EBITDA, so it's not expensive. As you say, that as they are acquiring and building out the sort of tech side, the subscription recurring revenues are growing as well, which is obviously positive for shareholder value creation. They did an acquisition in, I think, RSMR, the investment rating business to IFA segment. And then the other acquisitions were kind of mix of compliance services and product research databases. So, we're positive on that. Again, long-term story, really strong. It's inexpensive. Quality of earnings is improving. As you say, kind of one CEO now, so it sort of simplifies the kind of org structure. But just a high quality business, I think, that continues to deliver.
Yeah, and I think there's plenty of consolidation in that sector. Yeah. There's lots of big fund managers and wealth managers and people like that who want to get into that space, yeah. That's for sure. Good. Okay, let's go to another one, which is a bit of a special situation. It's got some financial services, Truefin. It's got three divisions. It's got a sort of like an early payment business that serves a lot of the public sector in the UK. Oxygen, I think it's called. It also has the invoice factoring business, Sartago. But it's one which has done really well of late is its gaming business, Playstack, that I think has got a bit of a blockbuster game it released, Bellatro. How do you see this one? The shares, again, have done pretty well of late, actually.
Yeah. The big driver here has been Playstack, the video games business. So if I take the negatives on this business first, the Sartago, which was, I guess, a bit of option value from our perspective, has they lost Lloyds, a big customer, and so they kind of have resized their cost base. And, you know, so that is, I think we sort of see that in the kind of value is zero. You know, it's probably not zero, but we don't have high expectations necessarily. It's a good business, subscale. Oxygen and Playstack are the key businesses, though. So Oxygen is a great business. It's a tech platform which provides early payment solutions to local authorities, really captive customer base who the revenue grows basically 20% organically every year without winning any new customers because of the maturity profile. It takes sort of 5 or 6 years to go up the maturity curve. So really strong, highly visible revenue growth. Operational leverage is massive. So the fixed cost base is not scaling at all. So you've got 60% drop through to the bottom line. And it's just a very high quality business that, you know, we've seen go from sub 500K of EBITDA to over 2, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you fast forward a couple of years, it should, you know, probably be 5 million of EBITDA. Yeah. You know, that's a business that I think they had an offer sort of that was announced from a potential acquirer a few years ago, which they rejected. And at the time, the headline multiple looked quite high. But if you look at it now, it's actually, you know, it was definitely the right thing to do. So that's just a steady kind of performer. And, you know, that is going to be an attractive acquisition at some point. But Playstack has been the sort of standout performer here because of Bellatro was one of the games that's performed exceptionally well last year. But it hasn't just been a single hit. It's been, you know, there's been a few others. Abiotic Factor has been really strong. And they've had a few others. And the pipeline looks really, really good as well. And it's been a bit of a virtuous circle for them because as you get, Bellatro has been a kind of runaway indie hit. And it's, you know, if you look at the numbers, the business has gone from, you know, Playstack has basically delivered high single-digit EBITDA last year from being kind of almost break-even. So the turnaround in EBITDA in a year has been kind of phenomenal.
Yeah.
But as some of these hits have started to be, they've become, you know, quite, I don't want to say cult hits because they've actually become quite, you know, they've become quite sort of mainstream in the indie world. The platform deals that Playstack have done have suddenly been just a kind of step change different. So, you know, before then, the terms that they would have been getting offered by some of the big platform players is, you know, it's now kind of, it's just a completely different conversation. So that again is a business which, you know, is has got real momentum. So you know, some of the sequels and the pipeline of launches that they've got over the next 12 to 18 months is very, very strong. The ability to continue to monetize some of the already strong franchises is really clear as well. So we expect this year to be another good year. And, you know, the share price has done well, but it's still, I don't know, the shares are like 70 odd million, 75 million market cap, but cash position is about 10 million or 5 to 10 million higher than it was. So it's still kind of, you know, the breakup value of Oxygen and Playstack is today, well, you know, it's probably a multiple of the current market cap.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's amazing how things change, because at one stage, about 3 years ago, everybody thought Satago was going to be the main sort of value driver, and then all of a sudden it's changed and the other two have really sort of like driven the performance. Okay, let's go to a final stock, but this is a sort of like a relatively sort of like everybody knows, you know, construction sector sort of stuff. We've got Costains that most people think, oh, you're never going to make any money. But these guys and Galliford Try, the share price has done phenomenally well over 2 years. How do you see this one and its prospects going forward?
Balfour Beatty is another one, actually, that we've had in another fund. It's interesting because post-Carillion, that blow-up, this sector was so, so unloved. And the Galliford Try was on a negative EV.
Yes.
Balfour Beatty's sort of operating business, when you take out the infrastructure investments, was on a negative EV.
Yes.
Costain was very cheap as well. And, you know, so I think with Costain, it's sort of construction and consulting business. So it focuses on transportation and natural resources space. So they do a range of sort of consulting around design, project management, engineering, design and advisory. And, you know, it had been kind of priced as if it was just quite a, you know, kind of cyclical, dull kind of private sector consulting business. Yeah. When actually it's got some really, you know, structural trends that are supporting the growth of the business. This, again, a kind of feature across all of these businesses has been this cash position is really strong. So I think they've got 160 million of net cash, which is 60% of the market cap. So strong balance sheet. Order book is really good. And, you know, it's moved forward materially at the latest announcement day. It trades at sort of 3x EBIT, I think 2.4 times EBITDA. So, yeah, this is... it's very cheap. I'm not saying the sector should be at 10 times EBIT, but it should probably be at kind of double where it is today in terms of valuation. I don't know. Maybe I think these companies have, the market has sort of moved on over the last 3 years to, rather than giving them a negative enterprise value, has decided to give them a kind of positive enterprise value and a sort of EBIT multiple of, I don't know, 2 to 3 times probably. So when it was obviously negative EV was definitely kind of the wrong valuation, but they've delivered quite materially since then. And so I think these are still way too cheap. Operational performance is good. And yeah, so I think, again, I think that we expect this to be a pretty strong performer going forward.
I know it's easy to say in hindsight, in terms of, you know, you see these turning around, but you're right. If, you know, the market just totally detests a one particular sector and sells them off, if you go into it as you do in a sort of like a 3 to 5 year view, then the bad news is priced so much into the stock that it doesn't need to be good news. It just needs to be less awful. And if it is, then it gradually builds, and you get to this situation whereby the stock now for Costains is still cheap, but it's what, 4 or 5 bagged in 2.5 years.
But I think the other thing is that there was a concern around some of these businesses around the contract dynamics and having fixed price contracts, which go against you in an inflationary environment. And Carillion, as I said, you know, was the kind of that was a high profile blow up, and it was, you know, really bad for the sector and for you know, the market. And so, you know, I guess for people looking at any business, there's a natural kind of, you know, bias to not look at it, just not want to go anywhere near those kind of businesses. So it's partly taking a long term view, but it's also really, you know, doing proper diligence on, you know, for example, within Balfour Beatty, over 80% of the contracts have got cap and collars, so they're not fixed price. And, you know, so doing proper diligence on the earnings fundamentals in the businesses to make sure that you're not going to be exposed.
Okay, good. Right. Just got one final question for you, Brendan. I've been asking everybody, there's one stock sort of like across the Gresham portfolio that really gets the sort of the Goulston blood sort of like flowing fast. What would be one was a sort of like really sort of an exciting investment story?
You're basically asking me to choose my favourite child.
I am. I'm sorry about that. Exactly.
So, look, one that I think is that I'm really excited about and I think is going to be a great performer this year is Diacetics. And look, they announced this is the kind of data business to Big Pharma around test-dependent therapies. So biomarker-driven therapies, which is growing massively as an end market. And, you know, they have moved their proposition on so significantly over the last 3 years. The business is, so I look back and for the year end, so 3 years ago, the business did 14 million of revenue. Just for 24, 3 years later, did 32.2. So it's more than doubled revenue in 3 years. The last year, it's grown revenues organically by almost 40%. So this is a proper organic growth business. The proposition is, again, over the time that we've owned it, is shifted to being, it's a sort of portal for pharma and biotechs to log into, and they can see in real time how many patients have tested positive for an indication where they have a drug that can address it, and then they can see they can use the tools to try and improve the testing and therefore increase their sort of revenue potential from it. So it's completely sort of evolved from, you know, to now being this kind of real time sort of intelligence platform. Again, the business model has gone from being probably 20% recurring to now 55% at the latest update. And that's on a trajectory to 70%. And the contracts that they're winning, again, when we looked at, so they recently won a couple of contracts which are worth sort of $4 to $5 million each. It's 10 times what the size of contracts that they were talking about when we first invested. You know, so the share price, if you look at the kind of over the last 5 years, the share price hasn't really done that much, despite the fact that this is now on a trajectory to being, you know, it's sort of 80, 85% gross margin. It's mostly, you know, more than half of it's recurring. It's on a path to being sort of 70% recurring. It's winning some very large contracts from Big Pharma. It's growing 40% a year. They've been investing, which is, meant that the cash flow hasn't come through yet, but this year we expect to be the first year. So the reason why I'm excited about it is today it's got an EV, it's got net cash on the balance sheet of sort of 12 to 15 million. It's got an EV of 100 million. And we haven't seen the sort of profits and cash flow start to ramp yet. But in a couple of years' time, this business will be making 15 million EBITDA.
Yeah.
And it'll be probably making about 60 odd million of revenue. So it is very, very cheap, but it's also, you know, versus the competitors, this is a massively strategic asset. All the people that we've spoken to about this who've been ex-Big Pharma, you know, GSK, Roche, all of them have just sort of looked at it and thought, why didn't I know about this when I was at Pharma? And how is it the only player doing this? And yeah, so it has carved out a really, really sort of compelling moat in this space. And I think, yeah, this I think could be well over 100 million of revenue one day.
Yeah, no, it's in a perfect position in terms of it helps Big Pharma accelerate the commercialization of their novel or new treatments. It helps the patient get the treatments that it wants on a personalized basis in their terms of their genetics and what they're, you know, the right treatment. So they get less side effects and they get the biggest bang for the buck. It helps the healthcare authorities because they get the patients who are delighted and it's less burden and less cost on their system. And it helps the company. So it's a sort of like a win-win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, that's a terrific idea. Thanks very much, Brendan, for that and for all your comments over the last hour. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. I've found it absolutely fascinating, as always. So very much look forward in touching base again in about 6 months' time, Brendan.
All right, thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.